podcast this week, an intro that hasn't had to be re-recorded at home for technical reasons. Plus, fantastic guests in the shape of The Fantastic Two, aka Matt Shackman, director of The Fantastic Four, First Steps, and Sam Rockwell, star of The Bad Guys 2. Oh, how exciting! And now we go back to the show that was recorded in the studio and they won't be able to tell the difference. Brilliant. Chris, you've done it again.
All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has finally got Michael Cicchino's theme for the Fantastic Four First Steps out of its head. Yes! Take that, Cicchino!
Oh, you mean like Fantastic Four?
No! It's back in there again. It is the earworm to end all earworms. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, we're in the pod booth, and I am joined by... Hello, Helen.
Hi, it's me.
How are you?
Good? Good. You good?
One colleague of such lethal cunning. Where is everyone? Where's everyone else? What's happening?
Well, everyone is James, and he ran past us as we walked out of the office going, I need some lunch.
So yes.
He's, I guess...
He's aware of what time we start these things, right? I mean, he knows.
It's very hard to say.
Yeah. We will grill him when he returns.
No, I don't think that's the kind of lunch that really sounds good.
Well, no, it sounds healthy.
I don't know.
Grilled lunch? That's better than a fried lunch.
Yeah, but a grilled James? That's not healthy.
No, I wouldn't grill James.
Unethical, too.
Yeah, I wouldn't grill a James if he was glazed in honey. But yeah, he is. He's eating food right now. The good thing about James, I don't know if this is something we've ever discussed in the podcast, Health Bells, is that he is the fastest eater I have ever known.
Yeah, you'll just be sort of, I don't know, unwrapping your fork from the napkin or breaking the chopsticks in two, you know, and you'll sort of be reaching in to like wind the first bit of noodles around your chopsticks, say, and he will have finished.
Yes, he will. He genuinely will. And he doesn't suffer from indigestion problems that I know of.
No, it must be all that natural bile.
I don't... It just dissolves stuff automatically. Is he like the reverse Sarlacc? He just digests things so quickly his stomach doesn't even know it was in there,
doesn't
so therefore
even,
can't
isn't
react.
Even aware. Exactly.
That's amazing. I don't think we should ever take James to a Michelin star restaurant. Because
I think not.
A, we can't afford it. But
yes.
B, on the rare occasions that we can afford to go to a Michelin star restaurant, I think James and a tasty menu would be strange bedfellows. He would wolf down, like, because they're small portions, right?
Mm. Oh, they'd
and
be gone.
He would wolf it down within 10 seconds. His taste buds wouldn't identify what pristine ingredients our good friend Heston had put on there.
And also, he would genuinely cause a bit of an existential crisis for the waiting staff, because these people are very highly trained. They are very,
very,
very on top of everything.
Yeah.
But they'd be like, did we put an empty plate in front of that man? He can't possibly have finished already, but there's nothing on it.
Sometimes when
they
you're...
They would think they're going mad.
Sometimes when they give you a new course, a tasty menu, and then they'll put a little sauce or a little soup or a little broth or something around it, and they won't have a chance.
It'd be gone.
It would be gone.
Yeah.
And then just... Oh.
The only thing left would be the tiny little edible flower on top, which he'd probably turn his nose up at. And it would just be sitting in the middle of this giant plate on its own.
So James, in many ways, he's like a miniature Galactus and a reverse Sarlacc. This is what we discovered about him.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's kind of weird. Oh my God, look who is. Okay.
Okay.
We'll bring him in. Jimbo, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, I'm Chris. This is Helen.
Nice to meet you.
This is the Empire Podcast.
It's been a very discombobulating morning, I'm not going to lie.
What did you have for lunch?
I had a salad from the little place next door, which involved pasta. It's like a melange, no dune puns intended. It's like a melange of pasta where you can go in and you have like they give you like a big tub. And then for like £7 something, you can fill it with as much salad,
right,
and pasta salad and eggs and things like that as you want. And if you really like tamp it down in there, like compress it, you can fit like 8 meals worth of salad in there for £7. So not only did I do that, I then consumed 8 meals worth of salad before coming into this podcast.
Yes, we were talking about how quickly you eat.
Mm.
We were saying that you are both a reverse Sarlacc, a in that you must digest things immediately, but also like a miniature Galactus.
Yeah.
Because you hunger.
Mm, I do hunger.
You constantly hunger.
I devoured it much like Galactus did, whatever that planet
did
was.
Did you send in a herald to the shop beforehand to announce
Nick.
your
yeah. Nick turns up on a surfboard and says, I am the herald of James.
Sprays himself silver like Nicholas Holt in
Mad witness Max. Him. He hungers. Please prepare him a salad and ideally a Diet Coke.
Well, there you go. Excellent stuff. Welcome to the Empire
Thanks.
Podcast. Shall we have a question? At Luis Tiago 1409, who asks, with Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four!
Oh my God. Is this the
maybe
thing we're doing?
Maybe featuring the first look. Well, if you'd been here for the opening 5 minutes of the podcast, maybe featuring the first look at Downey's Doctor Doom. Which actor played the most iconic combination of a villain and hero? E.g., in this case, Ian McKellen.
Damn it!
As Gandalf and Magneto. So he played Gandalf and Magneto, not in the same film. So we're looking for actors who have played iconic heroes and iconic villains.
Let me just spoil James's day here.
I texted you this morning.
Yes.
Okay. I believe you.
I'd like to spoil James's day by saying James Earl Jones, Mufasa,
Helen,
and Darth Vader.
No one has ever received a Hewitt Hollywood handshake this quickly in the podcast, and you're too far away. But I'm going to give you an air shake.
Thanks very much.
There we go.
So this is like what Biscuits Week, and I'm already getting the handshake.
Yes,
it's amazing.
Pretty much. If you brought me in like some bourbons, I would just give you the handshake. that's a great one.
That's good hero and villain. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, James Earl Jones, just full stop, right? I mean, because he's also played Thulsa Doom. In Conan,
indeed.
Right?
And Admiral Watts in Jack Ryan.
Yeah, and Colonel Quavers in Snickers. So he's got them all.
He has. He's got it covered.
And there's that bloke in Field of Dreams, the guy who sits there.
Yeah, I'd say he's neither a hero nor a villain though.
All right. Are you saying then that Mufasa is an iconic hero?
I think yes.
Because of the Lion King Mufasa.
Yes. Right. No,
because otherwise he gets bumped off quite early on.
Yes, I know, but like he's a hero to his son.
Well, most fathers are heroes to their sons.
I know, and isn't that wonderful?
Most fathers aren't trampled to death by herds of wildebeest.
True.
It was a wildebeest or antelopes?
It's a good question. I want to say wildebeest.
You missed out a good opportunity to say gnus there, but
a gnu.
You know,
is it gnu? I've never actually heard that word pronounced.
You never heard a gnu?
I've heard of a gnu, but I've always thought it was just gnu, and
you know
the G was silent.
No gnus is good gnus. So
certainly
you don't get trampled. Yeah.
Certainly for Mufasa.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mufasa sucks.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you tried not being trampled to death by a herd of wildebeest?
Gnus.
Yeah. I don't know.
We're going to go with gnus.
Yeah.
It's fun to stay.
They should have had some gnu control because gnus are an anagram of gun. Anyway, that's a good start. We're off to a good start. Jimbo.
I'm feeling the pressure. I'm feeling a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go with Alan Rickman.
Here we go.
And I'm going to go with Alan Rickman because obviously you need a heroic role. So I'm going to, for reasons, just choose Truly Madly Deeply. But of course, I will go with his most villainous role, of course, which is Love Actually. So, you know.
Yeah, he is terrible.
Yeah. Indefensible.
He's a hero, I guess, in Galaxy Quest.
He
Not
is a
the hero.
Hero,
but a hero.
By Grandfather's Hammer.
Yeah.
I will
what
avenge
a savings.
He does end up being a hero, I suppose, in Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Like Snape is a hero, ultimately, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, eventually.
But I think you're really reaching just to justify Alan Rickman, if I'm honest. In the same way, like, I could say Mark Hamill, who has been both Luke Skywalker and the Joker.
Yes, that's also solid. But he hasn't been the Joker on the big screen.
I think
or
one
has
of those
he?
Got
a Mask of the Phantasm?
Sure, yeah,
was that was he,
was he a theatrical release?
Was he in that?
I think he's had at least one theatrical release for one of his Batman movies.
Does it count if it's a voice performance?
Well, we just said James Earl Jones, so I'm saying yes.
It does count if it's a voice
performance. It does 100% count. Yeah.
Because both of those are voice performances.
Correct.
Wow.
How about, and I think this is again one that James will enjoy.
Yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold.
as the Terminator.
Yes.
And also as the Terminator.
I see what you did there.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
It's not bad.
Who, okay, setting the Terminator aside.
Okay.
Who is the best hero on Arnold's resume?
Who is the greatest hero? It is Dutch. Yeah, I want to say John Matrix, but it is Dutch.
It's Dutch. Of course it's Dutch.
Is it Dutch?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Dutch.
Because it's in Predator, which is like the best film, apart from maybe Terminators that he's done.
It's definitely not Doug Quaid, I can tell you that.
Doug Quaid!
That's right. Because is he Doug Quaid or is he Doug Hauser? Who can say?
Well, that's another film in which he is
both
playing
the hero and the villain.
A hero and a villain, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, he contains multitudes, does Arnold. That's a very good one. I like that. Because I was thinking about this earlier on. A lot of iconic actors won't want to go down villain avenue.
Yeah.
They won't want to do it. They won't want to be seen in a negative light. Arnold's a slightly different example because he was Conan before he was the Terminator, but he started off really, the Terminator was like the villain role right off the bat. And then he went into years of being a hero after that. But a lot of, like, if you look at, I'd say a lot of big A-list stars don't really do the bad guy thing.
Villains.
They do some.
Everybody at least dabbles in villainy at some point. I feel it's more fun, isn't it?
I think they can dabble in shades of grey. But I don't think John Wayne, for example, would have dabbled in villainy. James Cagney absolutely did. He was a guy who liked to walk both sides of the street. Bogart did, but Bogart was also someone who was a bad guy.
Yeah.
Kind of first in his career. Jimmy Stewart, shades of grey, but how many out and out villains are there in Jimmy Stewart's CV, for example? And then if you want to go forward into, you know, let's take Stallone, for example. Who's the big Stallone bad guy apart from Spy Kids 3?
Well, Stallone, okay. But like Harrison Ford played the villain in That Zemeckis with the forgettable title.
Yes, but the fact you can't even remember the name of the film.
No, but I can.
What Lies Beneath.
Oh, thank you.
And he was, of course, Norman Spencer.
Norman Spencer.
Remember these things.
He went, ooh, Betty. Someone's been murdered in the bathtub.
Ooh, Michelle. Keanu was a villain in Always Be My Maybe.
Technically,
he kind of was.
Technically, Stallone was a villain in The Suicide Squad. King Shark.
And really, isn't he the villain of Judge Dredd? When you think about it?
I mean,
okay.
Wow. In many ways, he is the force of authoritarianism, so yes.
I'm not going to accept Stallone.
No.
And I don't think I'm going to accept Harrison Ford either, because I don't think that Norman Spencer, Betty, is an iconic bad guy.
Oh, well, if you're looking for iconic bad guys.
Well, the example that was given to us by Louis Tiago.
Yeah.
Or Luis Tiago, I don't know how you fully pronounce his name, was two iconic characters, Gandalf and Magneto.
Yes.
So therefore,
that's a different question from have they ever played a bad guy?
Well, but I'm twisting the question to my own end.
Josh Brolin.
Oh, you're so predictable.
He's the villain in Sicario.
He's working through the four films he's seen step by step.
And of course, he is the hero in
Avengers
Infinity War.
Wow.
I'm just saying.
You could have made that hit stick another way.
I could have gone so many different ways. I could have gone No Country for Old Men, of course, but then we can springboard there from Javier Bardem and say he's the villain as Anton Chigurh, but of course, is the hero as Stilgar in Dune. So
is our hero.
The hero?
As Stilgar. He's not the hero.
He's the man who ushers in, he is the herald, if you will, of the Lisan al Gaib. So, you know.
Well, hey, isn't Timmy Toomeets also hero and villain in that same franchise?
He is indeed.
Yeah.
Hero and villain, much like yourself. The hero and the villain of this podcast.
He's a Broadchurch.
Mm.
Hey, Broadchurch. David Tennant, Doctor Who, and that killy bloke in Jessica Jones.
Dead Waterfell, also.
What?
Never mind.
Okay.
Thomas Hayden Church, if we're talking broad churches, he's very broad as Sandman.
He's quite a broad guy anyway, just generally speaking.
He is, but especially when made of sand.
All right, okay, I'm going to throw some names at you.
Go on.
All right, rather than just sort of playing a game of love connections from Thomas Hayden Church, Paul Giamatti.
This is good, Phil Mallet's Mallet. I really like this. We should do this every week.
We do.
I mean, that is actually true.
It's not far off what we do. Tom Hanks.
Well, the remake, the comedy.
Yes.
Not the Lavender Hill mob.
Lady Killers.
The other one.
Lady Killers.
Lady Killers.
We must have waffles. We must have waffles forthwith.
Yes.
Yes.
Not the only time he's
better than
film.
The original remake of the Lady Killers.
How dare you?
I know what I'm saying, and I don't believe it. Yes, he is. Oh, what's his name in that? Professor something.
Professor.
It doesn't matter.
Also.
Yes.
Colonel Tom Parker in Elvis.
Yes.
Bad
also,
guy.
The producer of my Big Fat Greek Wedding 3 film.
Wow.
Yeah. True story.
Cruise. Has Cruise played a baddie?
I would say Magnolia.
Tropic Thunder.
Tropic Thunder, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. He's not a baddie.
I mean, he's
Magnolia.
Kind of a baddie.
He's kind of a baddie.
Kind of a baddie in both of them.
Not Magnolia. He's not.
He is.
Yeah,
he's kind of like a public speaking incel.
He's,
I think you
he's
know
a
that's
Jordan Peterson wannabe.
Right.
We learn and we see that he contains hidden depths. Mm.
Sure. As do many villains.
How about Vincent in a Collateral?
He's just a guy doing his job.
Yeah, his job is killing people.
Yeah. Lestat in Interview with the Vampire.
Lestato, a guy who makes meticulous notes about football matches. And also bites people on the side. Yeah, Vincent's a bad guy. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Lestat is also a villain.
Okay.
Yes. All right, Cruise qualifies. That's good. What about actors who've played Bond? All right, the greatest of all heroes, Helen, I think you can agree.
Dalton, obviously.
Dalton. Mm. Okay, what's Dalton's bad guy?
The Greater Good.
Hot Fuzz. Yeah.
Mm. Yes, Simon Skinner.
That's right.
Yes. All right, that's Dalton. Has Connery got a great bad guy under his belt?
He must do.
Or under his toupee, wherever he likes to keep his bad guys. Like a really good bad guy. He is August de Winter, lest we forget, in The Avengers.
In The Avengers.
Not to be confused with
The Avengers.
The Avengers.
Mm. No, never really to be confused with that.
No. But
he definitely played bad guys more than that.
He's played complex and colorful, complicated characters. Mm. But as for out-and-out baddies, I don't know. I mean, does he become a baddie at the end of The Man Who Would Be King? You could make that argument.
I mean, he goes to prison in The Rock.
He does, but he starts off. But also, he's like...
He's not been convicted of any crime.
No. He's...
Walmart!
Roger Moore.
Oh, he'd be a great bad guy. Did nobody cast him as a bad guy?
I mean, he was pretty sinister in The Man Who Haunted Himself.
Yes.
But I don't know that he was ever the bad guy. T-Dolls, we've done. George Lazenby. let me see. Bronholm. He played that man who was clearly not meant to be Jerry Adams in that Jackie Chan movie, The Foreigner. He just happened to look exactly like Jerry Adams in that movie from a few years ago. So he can lean into it when he wants. And then we have Daniel Craig.
His Dark Materials.
Is he a baddie?
Mm, he kind of is a baddie in that. He definitely kills a child to open an interdimensional portal. I think that's...
But he does it for science, James. I thought you would have been down with that, Mr.
Hey,
I Love Thanos.
Hey,
over
Thanos
here.
Is a radical environmentalist, not a scientist.
All right, okay. Very, very quickly.
Okay.
I'm just going to go through some MCU people, not because it's the MCU, but because everyone's been in the MCU, so therefore they might throw up some interesting names.
Anthony Hopkins. Odin. Hannibal Lecter.
But he's never played a bad guy. What a shame.
Oh. Because as we all know, Hannibal Lecter was very troubled. He had a very troubled childhood.
In many ways,
absolves him of all his
the
his
true
sins.
Hero of the Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, boy.
Run far away, all the way to the MCU. Yeah, Anthony Hopkins. I love that that's the first person you went to when I said the MCU. And, oh, of course, Anthony Hopkins.
Naturally.
Because I was like, I want people who are in the MCU, you idiot. And I went, oh, no, he was in the MCU.
Well, RDJ was the villain in Weird Science, but, you know, I'm not sure I'd call
like
that iconic.
He was a henchman.
He was a dreadful man.
When I think of Robert Downey Jr., I think iconic heroes, of course. I think Harry Lockhart in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yep.
I think of Tony Stark in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. When I think of iconic bad guys, I think Charlie Chaplin in Chaplin.
Oh my
this
God.
Is a man who launched an unprovoked assault on comedy.
Jeez.
And maybe the guy who played in Oppenheimer, was that a baddie? That was a baddie, right?
It was certainly an antagonist.
Yeah.
He wasn't what you call a goodie.
Mm.
No.
Whereas in the MCU, of course, he's an Ant-Man antagonist.
Well, technically, he's a villain and a hero in the MCU now.
Is he?
Yeah, that was the premise of the question, you remember, back in the beginning of this discussion?
I don't remember that, no.
when you read the question.
Dim, distant part. Was there a question? Have we always been answering this question?
No, how is Tony the hero and the villain? Oh, because he's Doctor Doom.
There we go. There we go.
The penny drops. All right, yeah. Chris Evans.
Oh, he's played nothing but shitheads since he left the MCU. Are you kidding me? Like, they've all been absolute dickheads.
Yes, yeah. This is true.
The grey man's moustache, I think, alone qualifies him for crimes against facial hair. And actually, do you know what? You could have this, because you could have the grey man moustache as the villain and then the cat beard as the hero, and he could be, like, both sides
of the
facial
hair. Cancel each other out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
I came to this thinking there wouldn't be many answers to this question, and in actual fact...
There's a million.
There are millions and millions and
millions. You've blown my thesis apart.
Lots of people want to play heroes because they're the hero, but lots of people want to play villains because they're the most fun. So of course you want to play both. I do think it's probably difficult for people, though, who are, you know, traditional leading men and women, because you don't want to get pigeonholed in that or sort of ushered down the sort of villainous route by being, you know, English. Peter Cushing, Grand Moff Tarkin, and, you know, the vampire killer.
Well, that's a vampire. Dear Lord.
Are you sure about that?
I mean, yes. But even in Hammer, Peter Cushing would routinely pivot from hero.
Pivot!
And he would be Baron Frankenstein in one movie. Usually had a Frankenstein in the name, so he would help him remember who he was meant to be playing. And then Van Helsing in some of the Dracula.
The vampire killer.
Yes, the vampire killer, James. Yes, the quite famous one, as it happens. Christopher Lee.
Yes.
Who, of course, famously was Dracula in all those Dracula films.
Yeah, but, and Saruman.
But perhaps arguably the hero. Well, not arguably the hero. He is the hero. In Hammer's greatest movie, The Devil Rides Out.
Mm.
So they're all at it. What a waste of time this has been.
So the answer is everyone.
Pretty much everyone.
Everyone. Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman.
Yep. Leon and Commissioner Gordon, let's say.
Oh, I'm going to go with Jackson Lamb.
All right.
No TV. No TV.
I refuse to acknowledge these boundaries.
Just as you refuse to acknowledge the clock.
That's true. All of these things.
All right. Okay. So I was going to say, if you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast, you can get in touch with us via a number of methods, but really just watch me on social media and see where I rock up every single week. But I also think we have next week's question in the bag.
Ooh. What is it?
I can't remember.
Excellent.
But it was a good one.
Fantastic.
But it was one of those ones that needs a bit of research. So I need to let you guys know.
Yeah, maybe let me know now, so there's a chance I might see it before next week's podcast.
Although you might not be here next week.
That's a good point. Although I also might be. It's very hard to say at this point.
Okay. Well, we shall see. All right, should we have a question? A guest? Should we have a question? A guest? A question? Should we have a guest?
Ask
a question.
Ask a question of a guest.
Let's ask a guest of a question. Oh, God, what's happened to my head? Let's ask a question of a guest. Shall we have a question, guest?
Yes.
All right, good stuff. Who do you want? We have... Matt Shackman.
Great.
Matt Shackman is the director of the Fantastic Four First Steps, which is, do you know what number it is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
37.
Correct. It is the 37th film in the MCU in a row. And it's out this week in cinemas all across the globe, all across the multiverse. And it is the big debut in the MCU, of course, of The Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four!
And it stars Pedro Pascal and Vanessa Kirby and Joseph Quinn and Eben Moss-Bachrach and Galactus as himself. And Shackman, of course, directed also WandaVision, which is probably still the best MCU TV show. That's one of the things I spoke to him about whenever I sat down with him in a London hotel room about a week and a half ago now. And we hadn't seen the whole film at this point. Disney and Marvel decided to show just 20 minutes of the movie, and we talked about that as well, and a great many things besides. Here is Matt Shackman talking about Fantastic Four. Enjoy. Excelsior! We're delighted to be joined in the Emperor podcast by the director of the Fantastic Four First Steps, Matt Shackman. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, thank you for being here. So, Matt, I've only seen about 20 minutes of the movie so far. It is finished, right?
Yes, it is finished, yes.
Okay, or is that it? You've only done 20 minutes yeah. and you forgot to do the rest of the
exhausted.
Movie.
Exhausted, yeah.
You were like, I knew there was something. There's something we're missing. Oh, God, another 90 minutes, roughly. But yeah, yep. it's done and dusted.
It is now, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And you're exhausted.
No, I'm doing all right. I'm actually okay. Yeah, you know, okay. Surprisingly. I'm a little jet lagged. I'm a little tired, but it's been 3 years, but it's been really exciting. And it's been a dream project of mine. So yeah. I'm very excited to bring it out into the world and show it to people.
I'm interested in that journey, that three-year yeah. journey of yeah. yours. So did it begin immediately after WandaVision or during WandaVision? How did it start for you?
It didn't. It began... after WandaVision, because I went off to do a Star Trek movie that didn't mm-hmm. end up happening.
Yeah.
John Watts was going to direct Fantastic Four, yep. and he ended up deciding to step away because he was a little tired after making 3 Spider-Man movies and I think needed a break, which was my great fortune because I love the Fantastic Four and have since I was a kid. And so when I got that call to come in to chat about doing Fantastic Four, I was really excited. And I left Star Trek, which was a movie that was still sort of in development. But in some ways, they're very similar. You know, they were both created in the early 60s. They yeah. both are inspired by the space race and they have that similar sense of optimism. One's a found family, the other one's an actual family. And I was thrilled to join and thrilled to take over the reins on this one.
So you get the call, you come in for your first meeting. How set in stone is this concept at that point? And how much of this movie is you?
Yeah, no, I mean, not set in stone at all. You know, we spent a lot of time figuring out, you know, what this story would be about, how we wanted to get into this family, where we wanted to find them, literally, you know, what is this world that they're living in? One of the things we knew we wanted to do from the beginning is not put it in the Marvel's 616 universe, the yep. MCU universe, just because there are so many questions, you know, where have they been? Why did they not help defeat Thanos? You know, all of those things. Mm-hmm. So we decided it would be better just to put them in their own corner of the universe, which was lovely because as much as I love interconnected storytelling, and I do, and I'm a big Marvel fan, there was something refreshing about starting a world that anew, mm-hmm. Where they're the only superheroes. And I didn't need to, you know, lay any sort of, you know, sort of trail for other stories to come. It was just about these characters, this family. Mm-hmm. And to build a whole universe is really exciting as a filmmaker.
From the footage I've seen, you're not bound by things like the origin story. Yeah. We get it, and yeah. we get it presented in an interesting way, but you don't have to spend 20, 25 minutes on setup. So we start in media res, you're going straight in right away.
Yes, there have been other great Fantastic Four films, and they've all sort of done that story. So that was one of the things we decided early on, which is, hey, let's not do that origin story so that you don't know what that first act is going to be. If you do the origin story, then you kind of hit all of those common, well-known plot points. Spider-Man, when they brought Spider-Man to the MCU, yeah. they did the same thing. They Absolutely. Kind of just skipped, the field trip to the museum and the spider bite yeah. and all that. Yeah. And I think that was great. It opened up new avenues of storytelling.
Yeah, because if I see Uncle Ben being killed once more, so help me.
Exactly.
But with the FF, I mean, there's been a lot more Spider-Man movies. And so we've seen that origin, I guess, a little bit more. There's, you know, obviously, there was a Josh Trank FF and the Tim yep. Story movies as well.
Yeah.
And the Roger Corman one that no one has really ever seen or talks about.
It's on YouTube. It's wonderful. Yeah. Give it a view. Give it a watch.
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
So it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
We have those Fantastic Four actors in our movie.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Alex Holloway and all those. Oh, my God. That's amazing. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Little cameos. Yeah.
Oh, great. So is that something that you wanted to do?
Yeah. Yeah. Wanted to honor them. They did a great job. And the story of that movie, you know, and the fact that it never came out, you know, it's heartbreaking. But they all, you know, did their best job to bring that story to life. And they're all great. Yeah.
But, of course, you have those movies, to think about when you're forging this.
Yeah.
So, again, could you talk about differentiating this and what you set in the 60s is yeah. a great start right away.
Yeah.
But with something like this, where you have Galactus, you have the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
How do you go about making it markedly different from, say, Rise of the Silver Surfer?
Yeah. I wasn't really thinking about those other movies so much. Okay. You know, I've seen them. I respect them. I think they're great. But I was focused more on the comic books. I was focused also more on me as a person and who these characters were to me and what the emotional story was. And, you know, as a, I think if I'd made this movie when I was 25, it'd be a very, very different movie for many reasons. But now, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a father.
Yeah.
Like, and I find that draws me in a different way. You know, this is a story about parenting. You know, it's a story about a real family. It's a story about how a child changes everything, you know? And that to me was deeply personal because I've been through that. So many other people have as well. And I think we all know what it's like to be in a family, you know, the messiness, the good parts, the bad parts, the humor, the heart. And I think that's really what makes them unique in comic book history is just that they are a true, true family. There are a lot of found families, you know, Star Trek's one of them, and obviously the X-Men, the Avengers, you know, Justice League, all that, but a true family with, you know, with all of the complexity, that's what makes them special. And that's what I was focusing on.
And so bringing in that interesting wrinkle of Sue being pregnant, you know, Franklin, I presume is Franklin, in this movie, you know, being born, being part of the story of the movie.
Yes.
When did you hit upon that? Was that because of your experiences in life that you thought, okay, I need to bring this into the movie?
Very early on, yeah. I mean, I think so. I think that's what makes them so unique. I mean, Wanda has children and WandaVision, another project that I had. But other than that, there aren't a lot of, you know, parents and kids, you know, in the Marvel universe. And that is what makes them special, you know? And so, yeah, we skipped the origin story. We put it in a different universe. We put it in the 60s and we brought children into the story. So all of those things certainly differentiate it from other movies that have come before. But for me, it just became an opportunity to tell a story about, you know, all the things that we feel as parents. And then you get to multiply it by 1,000 because they're superheroes and they're celebrities and all the things that make them who they are. And they've been through an incident of cosmic radiation. You know, I think, you know, you know, when you have a kid, you go and, you know, worry about, oh gosh, I hope they don't inherit this part or this thing, and all the nerves you have as parents, you know, about having kids. Imagine if you also had cosmic radiation, you know, you'd also wonder if your child's going to be healthy, you know, or that what's it going to be like. And, you know, those are factors, parental anxiety, hoping for the best. And also, you know, it's rare that a president or a prime minister has a child while being president and prime minister, but these guys are the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
And they live in a glass tower in the Baxter Building. And bringing a child into all of that has big stakes, you know, and they, you know, big questions to be asked.
Did that change how you looked at the casting of the FF
Definitely.
As well? Not just in terms of who you were looking for, but in terms of things like what the actors were asked to test with, what sides they were given, that sort of thing. Were you focusing with Reed and with Sue? Were you focusing on that side of things?
Definitely thinking about putting together people who are believable as a family, people who are believable as, you know, husband and wife, as brother and sister, as best friend, that felt good as a couple, but also of the right age, you know, with having children, that, you know, that was a big part of it. So that was a, you know, big part of who we focused on and how we put those folks together.
How did you go about it? I mean, because Sarah Halley-Finn has been a huge part of these movies right back from the beginning.
Sure.
I imagine Kevin is heavily involved in this as well.
Yes.
So can you talk me through how you do that, how you find your FF as a collective?
Yes. I mean, can do it in a lot of different ways. Way we did it was to go after them individually, you know, sort of to focus on each part separately. I didn't ever have, you know, all four of them together, you know, auditioning or doing anything like that. But I slowly started to assemble components, you know. And I'm also a person who runs by instinct. You know, I do a lot of theater and I cast plays. Yeah. It's rare that I find two or three actors that are perfect for the part and I'm debating amongst them. There's one person who just says to me that it's their part, right? And I know
Is it that simple, man? You just go in and say, this is my part.
well, they don't say it. I feel it.
because there's some actors who might go, listen, I can't believe this is so easy. I should have been doing this all along.
Yeah. Well, in some ways it is, you know, the anxiety that actors feel, you know, they come in, they audition or whatever. And it really is so much as outside of their control. Like you fit something or you don't, right? And directors often talk about how 95% of the job is casting. And I think it's really true.
Yeah.
But when I met each one of these guys to talk about this, and some of them I've known already from before, you know, Pedro and I have known each other since we were very young, and Joe and I worked together on Game of Thrones. But I didn't know Vanessa or Eben before this. But each of them, I just knew that they were the right person for it. You know, I just knew that they were Johnny Storm, that they were Ben Grimm, that they were Sue Storm, or they were Reed Richards. I just knew it based on their other work, based on conversations, based on the vibe that you get. And you kind of have to go by instinct. Yeah.
When was the first time you had all four of them in the same room?
Was that rehearsal? All four of them in a room was for rehearsal. They kind of, you know, once I'd cast folks, we Vanessa and Pedro and I got together and did some Zooms and things, and they met up in person, I believe. Joe and Evan met up at some stuff here in London for they were doing press for separate things and got to meet each other. And Pedro and Joe know each other because they had done Gladiator together already. Yep. So, like, you know, they all, but together as a group was rehearsal. And we had 3 weeks of rehearsal before we started production. Yeah.
Was that a nerve-wracking day when you get all four of them together? Go,
no, please, super fun. You know, yeah. It's great to bring them all together. You spend all this time, you know, meeting individually and figuring out who is the right person for that part. And then you bring them all together and it's just a lot of fun.
I just spoke to Ralph.
Yes.
And he was saying that when he first met you for this role, that you've effectively offered him the role right there and then. And he was a little bit taken aback by that because he was expected to go through all kinds of processes and screen tests and all sorts of stuff. So you presumably knew with him the same way you knew with the other guys as well.
100%. Yeah. Yep.
So what was it about Ralph Ineson that made you think, this is the devourer of worlds?
You spoke to him. I think you know.
My ears are still recovering.
He's a wonderful actor. And you know, he has the greatest voice of anyone in the world. And if you're imagining someone who can be a 14 billion year old space vampire who eats planets, you know, that voice is 14 billion years old, right? He just has so much power. He's the sweetest person, the nicest person.
Yeah.
Wouldn't harm a fly or eat a planet. But as an actor, you know, I just knew it was the right fit.
Okay. Can you talk about the voice? Because we haven't heard the voice yet. So obviously I'm not going to ask for an approximation of it.
There's only one.
Yeah, yes. Precisely. But finding Galactus's voice, I mean, that must have been a hell of a journey. Or did you and Ralph know exactly what you were going to zero in on?
I mean, you know, we talked about it. We wanted it to feel timeless. We wanted it to feel unique in a way. It's less about, an accent or anything like that, and more just about taking his time, really, was a big part of it. You know, this is a guy who's 14 billion years old and moves at his own pace, and what is it like to be that big and that old, and sort of to sense that scale, was a big part of it as well. So listen, I mean, again, 95% of my job is casting, I guess, and that voice that he comes with is a big part of it. Yeah.
Ralph was telling me that he was actually in the costume for quite a bit of it.
Yes.
So what's it like when you have him in costume as Galactus towering over what? Is he towering over miniatures or is he against green screen? What's going on there?
We wanted to do things practically in the film as much as we could, right? So we built miniatures, we built amazing sets, we built Herbie robots and fantastic cars, everything that we could build, we built. We had a full Ben Grimm, you know, in all of his costumes with the prosthetic and all that sort of stuff there as reference. You know, Evan's performance was all mocap. Ralph was a combination of mocap and a practical suit.
Uh-huh.
Alex Byrne and her team, costume designer, built this incredible Galactus outfit. And we filmed him up on a giant lift looming above the Fantastic Four so they could interact with each other. And when we photographed Ralph, we photographed him like a miniature. We flooded him with light so that, you know, when you film Mount Rushmore, everything is in focus, right? When you film a human face, things fall off. And so the trick, you know, in the same way when you shoot a small miniature, but you want to make it feel like it's enormous, is to flood it with light. And so we used, we were very careful in our lensing and our lighting to be able to film him so he felt enormous. And then you add on top of that, a lot of CG to kind of help with the scale, whether it's, you know, dust and little bits of steam and all of the things that are our clues for scale, you know, and then trying to shoot him obviously relative to a surfer or to the Fantastic Four to kind of understand that scale.
And in terms of the scale, in terms of deciding how big he is in the movie, because Galactus' size has changed over the years.
Sure.
He wasn't as big as he is in the movie when Lee and Kirby first introduced him, but he's a big boy in this film. Is that in a way a reaction to things like Godzilla and Kong, that you need to have something that makes real impact when he when he arrives.
Yes, yes, for sure. I love Godzilla, you know, and Galactus is a kaiju in a way. And that he has changed scale. You know, he sometimes even changes scale within something intentionally. Yeah. But for us, it was about, you know, making sure that he felt incredibly formidable. And again, once he comes to Earth, you know, you have relative scale references there that are helpful. You know, it's what's harder is to make him feel huge when he's in his own ship, which is as big as he is, right?
Matt Shackman, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Okay, that was Matt Shackman talking about the Fantastic Four First Steps, and we will be reviewing that film later on in the show. That was a good question, guest. Great. Shall we have some movie news questions now?
Oh, please. Yeah, let's.
Yeah. What has been happening, here's one, in the world of movie news this week?
Oh, where do we even begin?
Shall we start with the trailer?
Yeah, I mean, the trailers, there have been quite a few, but one in particular.
Yes. Obviously. You should be the one to introduce this one, James.
Since I introduced it to you.
Yes, indeed. On stage.
On stage, yes. The first trailer for James Cameron's Avatar Fire and Ash, which lands on December the 19th, but of course debuts in front of Fantastic Four First Steps this Friday, the 25th, and then arrives online on Monday, the 28th of July.
Wow, you said that really fluidly, almost like you had previously introduced screenings of this trailer in the London cinema this week.
It's funny that, though. Yeah.
Amazing.
But of course, you wanted to see it on the biggest and best screen available, Helen, in 3D, the only way to watch an Avatar film.
Does look good. There's a lot of action.
It's the way Cameron does these things, doesn't he? Like, the first teaser for an Avatar film is always a vibes trailer. Mm. Like, there's not a lot of dialogue in it. It's largely just sequences and motion and the Ash tribe that we see, great big floating jellyfish balloons. There are some really interesting moments in there. Like, if you actually look at the trailer, which maybe gives, I'm not going to spoil them here, but there are some, if you're eagle-eyed, there are some moments in there that will indicate, I think, some quite major plot turns.
Mm. Whoa.
In the film, which is very exciting. But more than anything else, it made me realize how desperately I want to go back to Pandora. Just the music, just the theme to Avatar really kind of like, didn't quite bring tears to my eyes, but it got me very, very excited for this.
What is the theme to Avatar?
I can't hum it, but when I hear it, it's wonderful.
Interesting. Does it go like, Fantastic Pandora?
Yeah, it's basically that. Yeah. But what did you think? The visuals, I thought, were incredible. I mean, they're always incredible, aren't they? Mm. But I thought the Ash tribe have a very distinct aesthetic. We saw Varang, which is Una Chapman's character. She's the leader of the Ash tribe. We saw her with Quaritch in his blue form as well. But I noticed that the ultra-high frame rate was quite obvious in the trailer, and I think makes everything look so much crisper and clearer and kind of really immerses you in it. And I'm like, normally I'm a bit weird on ultra-high frame rate because I think it makes things not feel cinematic, but I don't think that's ever been true of Avatar. And he definitely did it in Way of Water. I don't know if he did it in the original Avatar, but like, he mixes up the frame rate. So for action sequences, it will ramp up to, I guess, like 120, and then it goes right the way back down in dialogue scenes. So it's not always ultra-high frame rate, but he uses it judiciously, but very well.
He does, yeah. It looks really cool. I had the same feeling. Somebody said to me that day, it's like, oh, who's an Avatar fan? And I said, everyone is when they're watching it.
Yeah.
And then you maybe forget, but then you watch it again, you're like, holy shit, this is good. So I feel like people who are, you know, sniping about it online have maybe forgotten.
First and third biggest movies ever made.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Not everyone going to the cinema can be wrong.
Let's hope not, and let's hope they all turn out again this year. It would be nice to see people get back in the habit of going to the cinema, which I think is one of the big problems we have right now.
But it looks good.
It looks like a progression of the story. It looks like things are developing. Yeah. Can I tell all the kids apart? Still not 100%.
Do you remember their names?
No, I don't. But I could pick out Neytiri and Jake Sully and the one who is actually Sigourney Weaver and
Kiri. You know, that's Kiri.
Kiri. Kiri, yes. So, like, you know, I've got some of them down in Spider. Yeah. I've got some of them down. I just need to pick up the others.
But it's just like it's a really transportational film, that is. All of them.
Well, there's a lot of transportation involved.
A lot of transportation involved,
giant jellyfish.
Skim wings, ikrams, all of them.
That's it.
In this trailer, do we see Piacan?
We do. He is there. It is a Piacan, not a Piacant.
It's too painful.
He's here. So if you're part of the Piacan hive, you will be well served by this trailer.
Who isn't part of the Piacan hive?
More of a pod,
yeah,
school,
you're right.
Surely, right? No? Or is
school?
It a pod? Is
no,
it more of a dolphin?
It's more of a pod. I think he's a cephalopod, isn't he?
I think so.
Okay.
This will be online on Monday, so you will be able to see it.
Okay.
But you should try and get to a cinema.
Yeah,
if you're listening to this right now, because lots of people will be going to see DFF.
Well, then you'll see it in front of Fantastic Four.
And then you can hear what Jimbo and Helen are we're talking
about. I'm curious to see because how they're going to show, because Fantastic Four, no one's going to be watching in 3D. So are they going to have the presentations of the trailer in 3D before the 2D film?
No, I think they're just going to do it in 2D. No.
It's a shame, though, because...
Is it?
Yeah, no, genuinely, and I will stand for this, I fucking hate 3D in films, except for Avatar.
Yeah.
So I think these films are conceived and executed with that in mind. That is his whole vision for it. And I think if you're not watching it in 3D, you are watching... Yeah, you're not watching Cameron's vision. James Francis Cameron, you may have heard of him. But you're not watching the film that he's making unless you're watching it in 3D. So I do think it's important to witness it that way.
I also feel like there's a difference between the people who know what they're doing with 3D and the people who don't.
Right, he very much does.
He really does.
But like in the same way that like Martin Scorsese dabbled with Hugo, Steven Spielberg dabbled with Tintin. Both of those were in 3D and were excellent in 3D. It's the same with James Cameron. If it's a director who knows their onions, then you're probably okay. Ooh. If it's a post, you know, conversion and nobody was really paying attention, then
absolutely not.
Thankfully, they've kind of fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, it's not really a thing anymore.
The way like Parker Selfridge has fallen by the wayside. Was he in this trailer?
I'm sure he's going to be.
He was
back.
Not. I didn't see Mick Scoresby either. But if you can't get into it,
get out of it.
Get out of it. As the quote does not go, you can't get into it. Get out of it.
And speaking of getting out of it, you've got to get out of it.
I do. I need to make a phone call.
Having given 20 minutes of your life to this week's episode,
please continue talking about news. If you could refrain from talking about anything I might be interested in, that would be great.
Well, I'll leave this with
I'll be back in a minute.
Yeah, this is a lot of leeway there.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
Bye. All right. Hell's bells.
Yes.
I think we're alone now. What else has been happening?
Have you seen that Luca Guadagnino is doing this film Artificial, which is apparently about AI in some way?
No, yes,
and
maybe.
Ike Barinholtz apparently is in talks to play Elon Musk. And it's being described as a comedic drama set in the world of artificial intelligence. I don't see how you can do a film set in the world of artificial intelligence right now and not have it have comedic elements. But yeah, it's apparently based around the period when OpenAI CEO Sam Altman was fired and rehired in a couple of days. And I guess that might be Andrew Garfield, who's apparently also cast.
Interesting.
But there's also Yura Borisov from Anora and Cooper Koch involved.
Helen's wading through the story in real time.
Yeah. Well, you know.
It's a discovery for her as much as it is for you, the people listening at home. That's interesting. Don't you think? Potentially?
Yeah, that's why I read it out.
Okay, good. Yes, well, that's all I have to say on that. It's interesting. And until we know what... Ike Barinholtz,
yeah.
God, yeah.
I feel like that's not the worst decision in the world. It's a considerable upgrade in handsomeness from Musk, but what can you do? And charisma and intelligence,
yes, but he's very good at playing idiots.
That is true, so he should be fine. Yeah,
that should be good.
Should be good.
All right. The sixth Evil Dead movie has started filming.
Oh, are you okay? Are you excited?
I am, as always with these things, cautiously optimistic because this one's not a direct sequel to Evil Dead Rise, Lee Cronin's Evil Dead Rise. He's gone off to make a modern version of The Mummy, which is interesting. And he had, if people listen to the spoiler special I did with him, he had talked about, he had ideas for two more Evil Dead films that would have been sequels to Evil Dead Rise called Evil Dead, now think this is right, Evil Dead Roar and Evil Dead Rome. But they haven't gone in that direction.
Rome instead, Italian or Rome like wandering about?
Wandering around.
Okay.
And this is going to be called Evil Dead Burn. And it's directed by Sebastian Fanicek and started filming this week.
Ah.
With a cast, none of whom I think were in the previous movies. That's correct. Hunter Doohan, Lucianne Buchanan, Suhaila Yacoub, and Tandy Wright. So that's potentially exciting. Evil Dead 2, of course, the greatest of all movies. I loved Evil Dead Rise. I thought it was absolutely terrific.
Yeah, me too.
So nasty and gnarly. Perhaps the one thing it was lacking was the chuckles, but it had made a very, very, Cronin had made a very, very clear decision to go for that sort of darker, nastier tone of the first movie.
Yeah, it takes a very strong stomach to laugh at that one.
It does.
I'm a little bit bummed that we're not getting any of the, you know, potential sequel angles to that as yet, at least. And it's been a good couple of years now, and I feel like we could have had three already. So I'm a little bit...
Just crap them out.
Yeah, well, not crap them out, but like, you know, give them to some hungry, inventive young horror makers and just let them go nuts. I just feel like we could have done that. And I'm a bit disappointed that we haven't. But I'm sure this will be fun too. Burn, huh? Does burning traditionally get rid of the evil in these films?
Fire doesn't really play a prominent part in any of them, but I imagine, I mean, you have to dismember them, generally speaking, the deadites.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Who knows? Who the fuck knows what will happen with this? But it is exciting. Another Evil Dead movie is on the way. Hell's bells.
Yes.
I've hopefully bought you time.
You have. I find that Naomi Aki, who has been fantastic recently in Mickey 17.
Fantastic Naomi Aki.
Correct. Mickey 17 and also the upcoming Sorry Baby. She is apparently the top choice for the female lead of Clayface, which is the third DC Studios movie after Supergirl, I think, will be out next, and then I think Clayface. So this is the one they've cast Tom Rhys-Harris already as Clayface, and James Watkins is directing, but apparently she is top choice for whatever the lead female role is, which is definitely a thing that I know.
Have they said what character that's going to be?
No, just said female lead.
Female lead, that's a strange name for a character, but we shall see what happens with that in Mike Flanagan and James Watkins, we trust.
Mm. Indeed.
Now, oh, hang on.
I'm back.
You're back.
I've returned. I've teleported back in.
We should talk about portals. We should talk about portals.
I have a question for you. Obviously, I wasn't on the podcast last week because I was in witness protection after saying bad things about Superman. But I wondered whether you guys talked about... It's absolutely true. I've been on the run from the DC mob. It's been terrifying. But did you talk about the Superman box office having made all the money in the world last week?
No.
It's done extraordinarily well, showing that I think the vast majority of people consistently disagree with me on this particular film. So, you know, that's good. That's a good start for the new DC universe, right?
It's done very well, yes. Yeah.
So what's it at?
I wouldn't say extraordinarily well. But
it's done very well domestically, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's less so, I think, internationally.
I think it's been a very strange summer at the box office,
yeah,
in that I don't think that there's a, apart from Lilo and Stitch, which has made $1 billion.
Stitch up.
Yeah. Stuff that they might have been expecting to get close to $1 billion, like Jurassic World, Rebirth. It may end up close to there, but I don't know if it's going to, and Superman's not going to, and I don't think Fantastic Four is going to. And then you have other movies like Mission Impossible, the Final Reckoning, which has made more money than the last movie, but some people will still consider that to be a disappointment because we're in a world now where apparently you make $600 million, and that's a disappointment. Jesus Christ, what's happening? Yeah. F1.
466.
Yeah, so it's really weird. It's just a weird, weird time at the box office this year. And Superman's doing very, very well. But, you know, again, I've heard figures bandied around like $700 million is what they need to break even. There's no guarantee they're going to get there.
No.
So it's really
likely,
interesting.
I think, at this point, but not certain.
Yeah.
I saw one story saying that James Gunn said there might be a bit of anti-American sentiment involved, that he's seen as such an American symbol, that there might be a little bit of that. I'm not sure it's that, but I do think there's an anti-superhero and anti-franchise and just anti-new versions of old things feeling around at the moment. So that might be part of it.
I was thinking about this. And we've got, what, is it a year and a half until Avengers Doomsday? Like, you've got a while. Mm-hmm. And what, we might get the Spider-Man before them?
We are getting the Spider-Man before them.
So, and how long away is that?
Next July.
Okay, so we got a year. We've got a year without any sort of Marvel cinematic installments.
And they've stopped muddying the waters, or pissing in the pool,
pissing
as you
in
say,
the pool, yes.
With Spunk. They've stopped filling the pool with Spunk.
No Spunking in the pool. It's not a bad thing.
No.
It's not a bad thing at all. And obviously we'll get on to whether or not there will be a palette that is cleansed or has a bad taste in it a little bit later on. But I do think the superhero fatigue thing is real, and I quite like the idea of just having a bit of a pause. I don't think it's a bad thing at all.
Well, we've got Supergirl coming out next year,
next year as well.
Yeah.
This was the other thing I was thinking. Like, part of me almost it's almost a shame that this is when DC is spinning up again, because it does feel like it's another wave. And I just think, for the sake of the genre, and we all love the superhero genre, right? I think for the sake of that genre's survival.
We do,
I think,
but not everyone else listens to it. Sure, us, yeah.
But we do. But easing off it, I think, would be to its collective benefit. Because,
and
I think
Feige
said this before, hasn't he? Like, it is the kind of rising tide lifts all boats things. Like, and people didn't necessarily differentiate between the core MCU and the Spunk movies. And mm-hmm. that if there are bad films or everyone's making these films, then the saturation affects everyone. Like, it's not.
But alternatively, you take the plug out of a sink and everything will sink to the bottom.
Right.
And that's a little bit what's happening as well. It's been interesting watching the way the Thunderbolts, which is, you know, a very, very, very good MCU movie.
It is a good film.
Has made less money than Captain America Brave New World, which most people consider to be a weaker entry in the MCU.
With good reason.
It's going to be fascinating to see what Fantastic Four First Steps does. Feige this week has been talking about stuff, and he has said, look, we've made 100 hours of content across movies and Disney Plus since Avengers Endgame, and it should have been 50. So I think now they are recognizing that Timmy failure, mistakes were made, and and they're hoping to reset and plow forward in a new direction.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that a little bit of, in fact, maybe even a lot of audience goodwill has been burned a little bit over the last couple of years. Can they get it back? I don't know. We shall see.
Yeah.
We shall see.
And I just don't think this is as simple as superhero fatigue, and I think all the people who are calling it that are kind of kidding themselves. I think that
they've manifested it for a while.
Yeah, there's been the people who have been manifesting superhero fatigue for sure, and who just don't like the genre and don't like how well it's doing and just are tired of it themselves. They've massively overestimated how many of these films there are. Now, that is partly because they get all of the advertising bucks, don't get me wrong. That they are the ones we see on the buses for months, and that's why they feel much more omnipresent than they necessarily have been in terms of sheer numbers. Again, if you compare them to like Westerns in the 50s, there are basically no superhero movies, but they feel omnipresent. And the reason that they feel omnipresent is partly the advertising, but it's also because the problem is more general. The problem is franchise fatigue, and we are getting starved of well-supported, studio-supported original movies. Mm-hmm. And I think there has been a fear of those because, yes, some have failed. Some are going to fail, guys. That's mm-hmm. going to happen. But because studios have this current belief that everything has to, and it's because they're so expensive, but they think everything has to and must make
massive
amounts of money.
It's because they
and
figured out.
If it doesn't, it's a massive failure. Like, it is killing cinema.
They figured out, or they decided, that spending $200 million on a movie that can make $1 billion was a better bet than spending $200 million on four movies that cost $50 million that might in the end just make $300, $400 million in total. You can kind of see why they did that.
There is an economic theory behind that.
Of course.
I did some reading on this for the book, and there has been, that was the kind of Alan Horn model.
Which book? You've got so many.
Was back when I did Wim versus Hollywood. Okay. Something I got into, but Alan Horn, when he was at Warner Brothers and then at Disney, basically brought this model with him, which was this tentpole model. And it's happening in music as well, where it is, you know, a tiny percentage of the movies and the music releases, in that case, make the vast majority of the money. So you double down on spending for those and make them make even more of the money. And you make more doing that than you do by making like 10 reasonably budgeted films, is the theory. It has held true for a couple of decades, but I do think it's now killing the golden goose. So anyway, I've
budgets
about
are getting
this
out of hand as well. Budgets are getting crazy.
Yeah,
and so a tightening of the belt and a bit of reevaluation seems to be happening. And one of the things that Feige confirmed this week was that Jake Schreier is going to direct the X-Men movie. Now, that's interesting because Jake Schreier did a very good job on Thunderbolts, but equally Thunderbolts did not do that well at the box office in terms of its comparison to previous Marvel movies. And you could even make an argument that it will lose money. And ordinarily, you'd expect then that director to be shunted off to movie jail and never be handed the keys to the kingdom again, but he hasn't.
Good.
It's quite nice.
No, I think it's good.
A recognition of the quality of the film over its performance at the box office, which I think Kevin Feige has referenced, the fact that there are factors there that are beyond the creative control, like that these characters largely came from TV, that people weren't invested in these characters enough. I think all of that is fair comment. Like, it is a good film. It does exactly what it needs to do. I think he did a really good job. So I have no, and I love the X-Men, but I have absolutely no problem with it.
And he handled a dysfunctional ensemble really well. I mean, what else do you want an X-Men director to have to prove, you know? That seems like a good thing. I am surprised that we, you know, I did think if they did do a launch at Comic-Con, we'd get an X-Men lineup reveal, maybe, potentially. So that's a bit of a shame. Maybe we'll get that in the near future anyway.
They might be wary of overpromising.
Kevin Feige did also say that there is still a Blade movie with Mahershala Ali on the cards. So
wow,
only ever been one Blade, only ever going to be one Blade.
Yeah, we shall see. There is part of me that just love if Marvel did a Comic-Con presentation every year and just kept bringing out Mahershala Ali and saying, we're going to be making Blade any second now, and it's like 30 years time, and this aged, wizened old man is wheeled across the stage.
Daywalker!
There's worse things out tonight than vampires. All my teeth are falling out.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill very slowly.
Why is he English?
I don't know. Also, why did he become Ian McKellen there? It's really hard to say.
Motherfuckers are always trying to get uphill.
You want to
all right.
Yeah.
Here's
the future, Charles, not them. They no longer matter.
They wish to cure us.
You've all discussed Predator Badlands, haven't you?
No,
we haven't. No, we were waiting for you.
Oh, bless you. What did you think of it? Because I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't that.
It's more Weyland Yutani-y than I expected. So this is a new trailer.
Yes. For Dan Trachtenberg's.
Yes.
Predator Badlands, which front and centers an adolescent, I want to say, predator on his first hunt. And has Elle Fanning as a synthetic, a Weyland Yutani synthetic, essentially helping him on this hunt. But he does appear to be the central protagonist of this film.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, we'd heard rumors of, but I was maybe unprepared for quite how it would be executed. I'm fascinated by it because, like, Prey works really well because it was a reset for Predator. Like, it didn't do anything, I would say, that new. What it did was take it right back to where it began. Different time frame, obviously, but it rekindled that feeling the original Predator had. You can't play that card twice. You can't do that again. So the question was, what is he going to do with this now? Now, I thought the Predator animated one, Killer of Killers, I thought that was really fun and again felt very, very different. But this is something else entirely. And genuinely, I think this could either be absolute genius or a very, very noble failure. It could be disastrous, but I'm choosing, hoping, praying that it's the former, that it's going to be fantastic and it'll just be something again, very fresh, very new that does this franchise, well, kind of both franchises, proud.
Yeah, it looks terrific. It looks absolutely blinding. I'm hoping it's as good as Predator 2. I mean, Prey was great.
Prey was
terrific. And this looks like a much, much bigger canvas. And Elle Fanning looks like she's having the time of her life in this thing. So,
half of her is anyway. She seems to spend half the movie in a state of dismemberment. But that's kind of interesting. I'm intrigued to see how this all links up and how they're going to fit this into the mythology of both. But
that's the only thing that worries me slightly is the need to kind of jigsaw piece it into this larger picture, which I almost think could be to its detriment. I think, you know, keep it like a very tense, you know, edge of your seat thriller. Don't worry too much about how it fits into the larger mythology. I don't think that's as important.
There's some very cool beasties in it, which I'm excited to see on the big screen. So,
Badlands looks like Goodlands.
Hey. Very, very good indeed. You know what? We're over a century now into the existence of cinema, and to my knowledge, there's never been a good movie called Badlands. So, finally, we'll get a good movie called Badlands.
True story.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was an exciting trip down movie news
lane.
Boulevard.
Boulevard, does that work? It's like Muse. Movie News Muse.
That's where I live.
you live 6 miles away from Movie News.
He muses on the Movie News in his muse.
That's right, yeah.
With his muse also.
With my muse.
Yes, with your
with my muse. I muse upon Movie News.
Do you like to take a snooze with your Movie News muse while you're in your muse on Movie News muse?
I can't even begin to parse that sentence.
Okay. Are you faintly amused by your muse on Movie News muse while you're musing with your muse on Movie News muse?
Okay, that's quite impressive. Gibberish, but I'm quite impressed. Genuinely quite impressed by that. I can barely form an actual sentence involving my own name, so that's pretty good.
Can you believe you weren't named in Time's 100 Greatest Podcasts?
No, I can't. It makes no sense.
They've made a powerful enemy of us on this day. Hey, come and see us live. Tickets are still available for people to come and see us live Saturday, September 13th, King's Place. Is the venue as part of the London Podcast Festival. It's going to be an absolute blast. We're going to have a whale of a time. It's not going to be just this. It's going to be other stuff. It's going to be like kind of an Evening with the Empire podcast
tongue twisters
type thing. There'll be tongue twisters. Mm. There may be a trip to a certain mountain. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
I see what's happening.
Who knows? Kingsplace.co.uk. To buy your tickets for that. And Jimbo, 2 weeks to go to pilot?
2 weeks to go to pilot 350.
Two weeks,
which is on the 8th, Friday the 8th of August.
There are
some seats left, and we have announced our guest, because we're actually going to be joined on the show as a member of the team by Russell T. Davis.
I can't make it. Oh.
Ooh.
Yeah. Russell T. Davis.
The Time Lord himself is going to be joining us.
So Boyd's gone to his...
Boyd's opened up the Rolodex. But it's very exciting. It's very exciting. I couldn't be more excited to have Russell on, because he's fantastic. So really looking forward to that.
All right.
It's going to be fun.
RTD.
The notorious RTD.
The notorious RTD. Exciting stuff. Kingsplace.co.uk to buy tickets to both Pilot 350 and our live show on September 13th, which will not be available as a podcast. So if you want to experience it, you've got to either be in the room or see it in streaming. And for it to be available as a streaming thing, well, we've got to sell a few more tickets.
You've got to be in the room where it happens.
Precisely. But anyway, shall we have a movie question guest, man?
Please.
Sam Rockwell?
Brilliant. Love
Sam him. Rockwell returns this week.
He dances onto the podcast.
Does he dance in this film?
Probably.
I don't know. I don't remember. But he a couple of years ago, he voiced Mr. Wolf, who is the head of a pack of animal criminals in an animated comedy called The Bad Guys, which was a lot of fun and did very well despite being released in the middle of a pandemic, and well enough for there to be a big old sequel slap bang in the middle of the summer season. And he is back with his voice cast buddies, Craig Robinson and Awkwafina and Mark Maron and Anthony Ramos. They're all in it. Sassy Beats, she's in it as well. Very exciting. Buttressed, shall I say, by the likes of Natasha Lyonne.
Mm-hmm. Danielle Brooks
and Maria Bakalava. And it's a caper and a comedy and a hoot and a holler and a hootenanny and all sorts of stuff. And I had a lot of fun talking to Sam Rockwell last night. He was in LA, I was in London. He was wearing sunglasses. Did it throw me? You're about to find out. Here's Sam Rockwell. Enjoy.
Hey man, how's it going?
I'm good, how are you?
Nice to see you again. What's happening?
Oh, not a lot. What about yourself? Just the usual, plugging away.
Just the usual.
Yeah.
If I put these on, it's only because the lights are very bright here. I hope that's...
No, it's cool. I think you might be the first person I've ever interviewed wearing sunglasses. I genuinely, like, indoors.
I don't want you to see the windows to my soul.
Because that's what this interview is, Sam. It's going to be a hard-hitting, investigative...
Yes. Yes, exactly.
We're both going to learn a little bit about each other at the end of this.
Yes.
But yes, you've I know you've just done some interviews with Craig. So is this a day like this? Because I imagine you don't get a chance to really hang out or even meet your co-stars.
Well, I'm a big fan of Craig's, and I didn't really get to work with him on the two movies, so it's nice to spend some time with him. Yeah.
Yeah, is that a weird situation though, when you've effectively done a movie with someone and then you don't actually meet them until the junket?
It is. It's strange, you know. I've met Craig a couple times here and there. We have mutual friends, but it's fun. You know, it's just fun to be with somebody who's like, you know, like that, who's very funny, and you can. It breaks it up.
So how does it work when you're recording lines for something like this? You know, do you record your lines first, and then are your lines piped into other people, or are people...
It's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of both. You record the lines, there's another temp cartoon, sort of like stick figure, moving stick figures, and then it gets more sophisticated, and then you go back, and at a certain point, it's sort of set, and then you can't really improvise, and you have to be... You have to sort of keep it as is, but for a while you can sort of mess around with it.
Because you're no stranger, Sam, to animation, to lending your voice to animations. So, you know, is there a Sam Rockwell technique? Have you got it down pat by now?
Well, I think that the technique is really just kind of keep it loose and try to be truthful in the midst of trying to be, you know, give everybody what they need in a kind of result-oriented fashion. You know, you're trying to come up with a lot of energy. You're isolated in a booth. Sometimes you don't have the other actor, and so you're trying to create something that's honest. And it can be challenging.
When you're going into that booth, when you take on something like this, are you thinking about great animated vocal performances that you're not trying to emulate necessarily, but you know, trying to get into the same kind of sphere as?
I do have, you know, some favorites. The Disney Robin Hood has some of my favorite voices.
Really?
Some of the Ralph Bakshi stuff, American Pop, Heavy Metal was a cartoon that I loved. You know, Looney Tunes.
Oh man.
You know, Popeye.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely grew up on that stuff, and you know, as a lot of us did. And so, there's a lot of Canadian animators, like the one. There's an animated Saturday morning cartoon called Cops that's really fun. Thundercats, you know.
So it's all like this is like a big blend. Yeah. Mr. Wolf is a big blend of all of those guys.
Space Ghost is one of the greats.
You are dropping some absolute gems here, sir.
But yeah, the Disney Robin Hood is one of my favorites, I think.
Well, Disney Robin Hood's very interesting because I don't know if you're aware of this, Sam, but a lot of people find the Disney Robin Hood quite sexy. And it's my understanding.
It is quite sexy, yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. It's my understanding. I don't personally find Mr. Wolf sexy, but it's my understanding that some people do. This film is packed full of sexy animated animals, if that's your bag.
Hey. Nothing wrong with that bag.
That's a solid bag.
Yeah.
You are a stranger, weirdly enough, to sequels. Now, you've been in sequels,
yes,
but not necessarily the originals.
That's right.
Technically your first proper sequel.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So going into this, was that a challenge or is it something that you just pick up right away?
It was a challenge. It's always a challenge to do voice work in a animated thing. This has been one of my favorites. F is for Family probably being the other one.
Mm-hmm.
That was really fun to do, you know. Netflix with Bill Burr and everybody and Justin Long. That was really fun.
Yeah, and that's a series as well.
That's a series, kind of rated R. Yeah.
Yes.
Really fun character.
But I'm guessing you weren't... Obviously, this isn't rated R. You weren't able to cut loose on this one.
No, I would do my version, my rated R version, then we'd have to tone it down. That was sort of a way of finding stuff. Yeah.
But he has an interesting dilemma in this one, Mr. Wolf, because after the events of the last movie, you know, he's effectively asking people to give him a chance and to give him a job. And is that something that you could relate to, I guess, going back to the early days of your career?
Sure. I worked in restaurants and delivered burritos on a bicycle and, you know, did things like that. I worked for a private investigator for a while who didn't pay me. And then I did a lot of odds and ends, TV commercials and extra work and, you know, stuff like that. Studied acting, yeah.
And were you thinking this isn't going to happen? I'm not going to get my break. I'm not going to make it. Or were you just relentless in your pursuit?
I didn't really have a plan B, so it would have been rough.
What about the private investigating? That sounded pretty interesting.
No, that wouldn't have been. I wouldn't have been too good at that. I don't think. Yeah.
What were you doing?
It was kind of boring.
Yeah. Was it just like? Yeah. Just listening to transcripts of conversations, things like that.
Not even that exciting.
What were you doing? Was it just light admin?
Well, we did follow someone who was having an affair, and then also there was things like going to the library and researching real estate, or going to a house and taking a picture of a thing on a house, you know, like just random weird stuff.
Okay. All
it was
right.
More like an intern, an assistant to a private investigator. I wasn't the actual, you know, I wasn't the, what do they call it? Yeah.
The actual private eye.
Yeah, I wasn't the main guy.
You weren't the main guy, but maybe after, 6 months or a year, you might have become the main guy, which is...
I don't think so. I think it would have taken longer. I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a guy in my acting class who was doing it. He got me into it, yeah.
But then you were getting gigs, you were getting jobs at the time, so people were giving you chances. What was the first thing for you that really clicked?
The first thing for me was probably, Box of Moonlight was the first one where I got some attention at Sundance and stuff. And then Jerry and Tom, Lawn Dog, Safe Men. And then eventually Green Mile and Galaxy Quest were the first studio movies I did. And those were the first bigger studio films that I did, yeah.
But despite all that, despite the career you've had over the years, no sequels apart from Iron Man 2 and Trolls World Tour. Is this something, you know, that just never quite happened, Sam? Or are you, in some ways, are sequels anathema to you? Are you taking a stance against them until now, of course?
No, I have nothing against sequels. I love sequels. Godfather 2, you know, Aliens. I love a good sequel. I just haven't been fortunate enough to catch on with one.
What stands out for you in a sequel? What are you looking for in a sequel?
Well, you have to change it up a little bit, right? You have to make it like a different, you know, Aliens is almost, it's a different genre to the original Alien.
Yeah.
You know? You could say the same about Godfather 2. You know, there's like flashbacks in it with De Niro. It's a different kind of narrative. Yeah. So I think they shake it up a little.
Mm-hmm. And with this one, I mean, but this one's very, it's unashamed in that first, what the opening credits say exactly what the movie is. And it's a blast. It says, this is a caper.
That's right.
Were you looking for, you know, just that sense of freeform fun?
Yeah, I was. I mean, you're always looking for fun, you know. It's a good time, you know. I mean, it's a great group of people. The cast is really hilarious. It's really fun people. I've known some of these, like Natasha, I've known forever.
Yeah.
It's really fun. And I worked with Zazie recently on another film, a Gore Verbinski film in South Africa. Yeah. And that was really fun. So I was like, but yeah, it's good, you know. Really good actors.
And then you get to see the film. And of course, this is the interesting thing about doing it this way, is that you don't have, I guess you don't really know what decisions or choices they've made. And they have no idea of the choices you've made.
That's
as,
right.
as well.
They bring you in on it later on. I got to work with Danielle. She was lovely. I really liked working with her. Colin Jost did a little thing in it. It was fun, you know.
Okay, so he came in and he was in the booth with you for a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, he actually did a punch up on a scene I did with Danielle, and it was really helpful. Very funny.
Amazing.
Very funny guy. I was blown away, actually, when I saw the final screening, the final cut. The stuff in space,
yeah,
in particular, is very, very impressive. Yeah.
Sam, you're no stranger to space either.
That's right. Indeed. Galaxy Quest, Moon.
Yeah. There's the pattern here, the Sam Rockwell pattern.
Yeah. Hitchhiker's right. Guide to the Galaxy.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm gonna let you go in a second, but what is the Sam Rockwell film that hasn't had a sequel that you would like to see a sequel to, and it doesn't have to star you?
Probably one where my character dies and then he gets brought back. He gets brought back to life. Like Snow Angels. No, I'm kidding, of course. That movie, you don't want a sequel to that. I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. That would be interesting.
Well, I mean, people have been agitating for a Moon sequel for years, right?
Oh, yeah. That would be fun. I would do that. I mean, You know, Lawn Dogs would be a good sequel. I think Box of Moonlight would have a good sequel, maybe.
Yeah, that'd be cracking. That'd
yeah,
be good.
That would be cool. Yeah.
Could I interest you in a Galaxy Quest 2?
Listen, I'm in. I'm waiting for the call, man. We almost did that, and then the late great Alan Rickman passed away, and that would be tough to replace. You'd have to figure that out.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a tough act to follow.
Helen
Mirren or
somebody.
Yeah.
You'd have to go Helen Mirren or Chris Walken or something. You have to go a very different way.
Can I interest you, sir, in 4 billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri?
Whoa. What happens there?
I don't know.
Wow. Me and Fran get married or something. Yeah.
It's completely
have
different
have
genre. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a war movie.
Okay, let me think. Let's think on that.
All right, we'll think on it. All right.
I ask Martin about it. Yeah.
All right. Next time we speak, you'll have an answer for me on that one.
Okay. Brilliant.
All right, Sam. It's always a pleasure, sir. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks
for your time.
A lot. Nice to see you.
Okay, that was Sam Rockwell talking about The Bad Guys 2, and talking about The Bad Guys 2 leads us to the movie reviews section. We'll just get into our car and drive to Movie Reviews Muse, which is just next to Movie News Muse.
Oh my god!
and there's a lot of stuff to talk about this week.
Mm.
One of which is not Happy Gilmore 2.
No, Netflix have elected not to show that to critics because they are worried that plot points and spoilers may get out for, again, and I cannot stress this enough,
Happy Gilmore 2.
Have some respect.
He plays some golf.
Yes.
You of all people, Chris, should understand.
I think when it comes to a comedy, the plot is not important.
And I mean, if you're worried about spoilers, just say, hey, guys, please don't spoil the film for other people.
Yeah, but then they show it to dreadful influencers and things like that, and they don't care.
A choice would be not to do that. You know, I'm just saying choices exist. Anyway, so maybe if we're really organized, we'll get online tomorrow morning and watch it together. And
I don't think that's going to happen.
No,
now,
I
sadly.
Don't either.
But if we don't do that, then we will review Happy Gilmore 2 on next week's show. But this is something that I want to talk about very, very quickly before we get into the films we can talk about. Comedy on the big screen has been very, very neglected over the last few years. Next week, we have The Naked Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot riding on that movie. And I think there's a huge appetite. I sense, anyway, a huge appetite for people to sit in a room again and have a great big old laugh at something uproariously silly that doesn't have any high pretensions whatsoever and is there just as a gag vehicle. With that in mind, I know Netflix are Netflix and they do what they do and I know why they do what they do. I genuinely think had they released Happy Gilmore 2 in cinemas next week, we could be looking at least a $70 million opening weekend because the first Happy Gilmore is beloved. Might be completely wrong about that, but I sense out there there's a huge, huge appetite from comedy fans for this movie and also just to see a fucking comedy on the big screen again. And hopefully that means The Naked Gun will do well and then it will lead to loads and more comedies being made for the big screen. But it just frustrates me that Happy Gilmore 2 is not going to be seen on the big screen. I am genuinely hopeful and optimistic for this movie. And so
it's a sequel to one of the early funny ones, so
yes,
I'm hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely. So fingers crossed. We'll be back next week or maybe tomorrow, but I've looked at my schedule, so next week with our review of Happy Gilmore 2. So where should we start?
Shall we do Bad Guys 2? And get that out of the way, and then James will remain engaged.
We have to give proper care and attention to The Bad Guys, too.
No, but not to get out of the way. It's a film I really enjoyed. We had fun. We saw it together.
We did, yes.
But I'm just thinking in terms of James's attention span.
He may doze off.
Yeah. Hey, I resemble that remark.
that salad is working its magic on him right now.
I was musing about movie news.
Dear Lord. All right, Hell's Bells, Bad Guys 2.
Bad Guys 2, yes. So this is directed by Pierre Perifel, with a co-direction by J.P. Sand.
Easy for you to say.
Not really. Mr.
Easy Wolf comic.
Is Sam Rockwell, Mr. Snake, Mark Maron, Mr. Shark, Craig Robinson, Mr. Piranha, Anthony Ramos, and like, good luck to you if you've spotted his voice. It took me the entire film. Awkwafina is Ms. Tarantula, and they are the bad guys, and they went straight at the end of the last film, but they are haunted by their criminal pasts and struggling to land jobs because obviously nobody trusts them because they were bad guys for so long. So after a little bit of a flashback to remind us that they used to be bad guys and they used to do cons and heists and, you know, cat burglary and stuff, then we find them struggling in the present day. And what's worse, some bad people are mimicking their old MOs to cover up a new series of crimes. They have to work with the police to try and solve these crimes and clear their names and hopefully become at least enough of a hero that someone will give them a day job. That's kind of the aim in the film. And of course, it doesn't become quite as easy as that because these new bad guys are quite bad. And they're led by Kitty Cat, voiced by Danielle Brooks. So they've got to figure stuff out. Solve some very, very obvious, if I'm honest, twists and turns.
Hey.
No, I mean, like, there's one character and you're like, that person's definitely going to be bad. And then they are, you know? But at the same time, I had so much fun with this. The funny bits are genuinely funny. The animation style is colorful and poppy. It has a little bit of a Spider-Verse-iness to it, but it's not just aping Spider-Verse. It's just got its own kind of little thing. The character design is cool. I really enjoy them all. They're just nice to look at. If you're looking for a sort of, you know, replacement for Disney's Robin Hood and kind of the sexy wolf kind of stakes, you know, this guy will do it for you. I just feel like they're a good bunch of people to hang out with. And they're a lot of fun. And the only people I wouldn't recommend this film to, and I say this with all sincerity, are physicists. There is a scene in this film that involves a chase and involves a rocket. And I would implore you, if you are serious about the study of physics, not to watch that scene. It will really upset you. Even for an animation, I think it's like, it's a lot.
What if this inspires a generation of new scientists?
What if it does? Yeah, I'm more worried it'll traumatize the existing generation, if I'm honest. But look, I had an absolute blast. I thought it was really funny. There are jokes for the grown-ups, and they're not just pop culture references, but there are pop culture references as well. But there's just a kind of zippiness and an edge and a wit to it that I really appreciated. But I did also laugh uproariously at the fart jokes. So
there's a great fart joke. Yeah. It reminded me a little bit, not quite as great and not quite as gag heavy or relentless in its pacing as Madagascar 3, which I kind of love. But I had a very, very good time with it. I enjoyed the first one as well.
Disco Afro.
Yes. I enjoyed the first one as well. I had a good time with the first one.
Yeah, the first one was fun. I think this one, underrated, from memory, is more fun.
Oh, interesting. I like the first one. I thought it was good. I mean, it was pitched as animated, child-friendly Tarantino. I was like, you know what? That's not that far from the mark.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not
Tarantino.
Yeah. Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Pulp
Fiction. All good. I like that. Good. Yeah.
Literally Reservoir Dogs. let me see what else. No, okay, we're done. Okay.
the hateful, the not very hateful 6.
Kill Bull.
Kill Gerbil.
Kill Gerbil.
Yeah. I think he's a hamster, actually, but, you know.
Yeah. Can we talk about the fact that every animal in this movie is deeply sexy?
I mean, I feel like I already touched on that with the whole Robin Hood comparison.
But yeah.
It's quite disturbing, actually, isn't it?
It is really disturbing.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Mr. Wolf and the lady...
Foxy,
yeah.
Whoa. Which is the Zazie Beetz character, we should mention.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, they're both, like, smoking hot.
Smoking hot. And
Kitty Cat has been hitting the gym like you wouldn't believe. Oh, my God.
And Mark Maron's snake and Natasha Lyonne's character have a very steamy relationship, which makes 50 Shades of Grey look like play school.
Wow.
Yeah. And also, like, Mr. Snake keeps stripping to show off his... It's not a six-pack. I don't know, 64-pack or something? Because he's a snake. Because they just keep going.
Kind of... Already indecent, so.
Well, you know.
He's hench. Thick and swole.
A hench man. But a snake.
But a snake.
A hench snake. And so I honestly, I had passed out halfway through this movie.
I had to revive him.
From your
not from exertions, but just out of shock of what I was seeing. I couldn't believe how sexy these animals were. Very sexy animals. So our official Empire reviewer was perhaps not as taken by the film's sheer unrelenting sexiness as as I was, and they gave it just 3 stars. 3 stars in for The Bad Guys 2. Out in cinemas this weekend, or you can just look for it next week on Pornhub.
Oh no.
Next up, The Fantastic Four, First Steps. Jimbo.
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
This is the latest, and let's be honest, last for a while installment in the MCU, but this is Matt Shackman's Fantastic Four First Steps. And this takes place on Earth 828. An Earth that, as I understand it, is kind of in its present day, but its present day looks like our 1960s, broadly speaking.
But cooler.
It's a sort of retro-futurist 1960s, feels like a theme park, it's beautiful. And in this world, there's not an abundance of superheroes as they are on our Earth. There is one group of superheroes, the First Family, the Fantastic Four, who are, lest we forget, Sue Storm, a.k.a. See-Through Girl, played by Vanessa Kirby.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Fantastic, a.k.a. Bendy Stretcher-Rooney.
Yep.
Played by Pedro Pascal.
Yep.
Rock Body, The Thing, played by Eben Moss Backrack.
Yes.
And Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, a.k.a. Flame Boy. We don't get to see their origin story in this. That played by Joseph Quinn, that's right. We don't get to see their origin story, but we do, because it's a series of flashbacks which take place in a news report, so it actually deals with it quite well. So we're not sort of laden down with the whole, they go into space, they get bombarded with cosmic rays, we kind of get it all in pricey. And very smartly, we see them fighting a variety of supervillains also in these kind of news reports, which sets the scene for who they are and what they do before sort of laying the canvas for the big bad, which in this case is Finchy from The Office, a.k.a. Ralph Ineson, who plays Galactus, he hungers. And of course, his herald, the Silver Surfer, played here by Julia Garner. It's a big galactic threat. This is not what I would describe as a big galactic film, although it is galactic. It's, I would argue, the most accessible MCU movie they have ever made.
I think that's right. You don't have to have seen anything else.
You don't have to give a shit about where it's going.
No.
It's completely standalone. It's also quite simple. It's quite easy to follow. It's quite light. You could argue it's slightly slight, honestly, but I actually think it works really well. I'm not saying that it skews young. I think it's very broad in its appeal. Like, it's all age groups. I think there's something in there for you here. I also really like what they did with the Fantastic Four. I mean, what Josh Trank did with them was less good. I mean, that was quite dark. But what Tim Story did with them was, I guess, the closest in tone, in that it was a kind of fizz-pop bubblegum version of this family. But they sort of lapsed into those archetypal tropes where Johnny Storm is this sort of like cocksure ladies' man, and The Thing is like full of self-loathing and misery and depression. And I like that that's not what these characters are. They're all just lovely. They're all lovely people. The familial bonds are delightful. The whole thing feels incredibly optimistic and just fun and playful and just delightful. There's a wholesomeness to this movie that I think A, plays to its strengths, but also feels a little bit like what we really need in 2025. Now, honestly, this film is not what I wanted. It genuinely isn't. This is not what I wanted from this. I wanted something tied into the larger mythology. I wanted this to have all its tendrils going into Avengers Doomsday. I wanted it to set the stage for a big MCU canvas. But I actually think what it delivered is something smarter, which is something that feels of a piece with the MCU, but also distinct. It feels like its own thing. There's nothing else in the MCU that feels anything like it. And part of that is this 60s setting. And I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, I don't love the Fantastic Four as a group in the comics.
No.
I find them quite twee and a bit stupid. But
they speak very highly of
I'm
you.
Sure they do. But genuinely, and I don't think they would have lent themselves to, certainly the way we understand it, certainly the way they appear in this film, to the broader MCU timeline as we understand it. I think putting it in this alternate Earth, putting it in this very cutesy, sweet 60s setting where everyone behaves in a really heightened, sort of like It's a Wonderful Life-y kind of way, works brilliantly. And you buy it 100%. And I think by the end of this film, you know them so well and you like them so much that then if you transplant them, as obviously will happen
at some point, yeah.
At some point into the, then they'll fit in fine. So actually, I think there's a lot of genius going on here, even if it's not what I would have chosen.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's not that there's no conflict between them. It's not that they're twee, like you say. They do kind of butt up against each other and tease each other and get frustrated and cross and, you know, have mild arguments. But it's done from a place of love. It's a family who are having these mild disagreements. It's not serious stuff. And what I think is really interesting about this film is that it leans in less into their superpowers, their primary superpowers, and much more into their secondary characteristics. So it's not so much about the fact that Reed can stretch really far. It's about Reed is very, very, very smart.
And socially awkward.
And so, I mean, he's very kind of like autism may be coded in this movie, I think. And it's a brilliant characterization, which I loved. But also like, and he's basically, he's falling apart at the seams when we meet him, because as you've seen, if you've seen the trailers, if you've seen any of the footage that's out there, they are about to have their first child, he and Sue Storm. And, you know, he's kind of spiraling. He's like, I have to keep this child safe. How do we do that? Is this child going to be okay, given that we got superpowers? What's going to happen? And I think that's a really, really interesting place to have your big hero of your movie from the start. I also love, like, Sue Storm, who can be and has been totally forgotten in some of these movies, looking particularly at the Josh Trank. In this case, really is the heart of the team and really is, and again, secondary characteristics, not just about the shields and the invisibility and all of that. It's about the fact that she is the diplomat. She is the one who can bring everybody together. She is the one who can literally go to a civilization of mole men and sign a treaty with them. And I think that's so interesting as well. You know, the same with Johnny, the same with Ben. It's not leaning into their superpowers. It's leaning into them as people. Mm. And I think that's why you end up with this incredible warm glow towards all of them that certainly the Josh Trank film didn't do. And to be honest, the Tim Story one came closer, but didn't do to this extent. So I really enjoyed them just as a team, as a family, as a group of people to hang out with.
Same.
As you said, the aesthetic, the sort of 60s futurism is just cool and fun and different. This is, at this point, unconnected to any other Marvel, history. You don't have to do any research. You don't have to know anything going in. This is a really good intro for little kids or your parents who are sick of the whole thing. You know, they could enjoy this as well. And it's a good time at the movies. It's not all action. I think some people have dinged it for not having enough action. I think it's got just enough. And I think we get not spoiled is not even the word, but we just want, people complain if there's not enough action, they complain that there's too much, and there isn't.
There are two major action sequences.
But also fine.
A different type of action, I think, we see in a lot of the MCU movies, and I think it works really well, and it feels quite fresh. I also, having come from a place where I couldn't see how Galactus could work on the big screen, I think they did an extraordinary job of being, you know, true to that character and making it not seem daft.
Yeah.
I really liked the Galactus stuff. I thought, you know, this sort of kaiju-sized energy, this kaiju-sized enemy is it works really well.
And energy.
Indeed.
I'm a big Galactus boy. I love my Galactus. And I was nervous about how he was going to be depicted on the big screen. And I think they absolutely nailed it. I think Galactus's introduction in this movie is one of the best sequences in the MCU. Mm. It is genuinely awe-inspiring / terrifying. You see someone like Reed Richards, who, you know, maybe has the biggest brain in all the MCU. It just reduced like a babbling mess in front of this incredible cosmic entity. I also enjoyed Julia Garner as the Silver Surfer. It's more emotional and earnest, I would say, than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. I was expecting a great big dollop of glib and some quips. And you get some quips and you get a little bit of glib, but it plays the last half hour for high emotional stakes, and that's kind of refreshing. For me, Thunderbolts is the best MCU movie of the year, but this is very, very solid.
I did think, for me, none of the jokes landed, and I mean none of them. Like, as in, a gentle smile, but like, I didn't think the jokes were, I mean, I don't think they were trying for quippiness, as you said, but they were quite sort of, let's be charitable and say they were gentle.
I think, yeah, gentle's probably right. There's a very good scene between Ben and Reed that I very much enjoyed, the jokes in that. But there's a running gag about clobbering time that I didn't think was funny.
No.
But I just like them all. And it's a great, it's such a charming Pedro Pascal performance. I know that's probably a, you know, tautology, of course. It's charming. Yeah. They're all charming. But this one is a particularly charming Pedro Pascal performance. And Vanessa Kirby, who is an actress who can be quite icy on the screen, I think, is so warm and so lovely here.
Yeah, she's good.
It was a real revelation. I have issues with like Johnny Storm's hair color and eye color, but apart from that, Joseph Quinn, lovely, warm, period appropriate. It was all hitting in the right places. I just think these are good characters to hang out with, and especially coming after Superman, which okay, not for everybody, but for me was also a very warm-hearted, sincere, cheering film. You know, this is a good summer for sincerity and earnestness, I think, at the movies.
I'm intrigued and excited to see these characters again. And we have already recorded a spoiler special with a Team Empire discussion about the movie that is available right now in your spoiler special feed.
It's been a pretty fucking good month to be a subscriber to spoiler specials.
It has, and it shall continue, but it's been a very, very good month just in terms of stuff. But what we're doing with the spoiler specials is we've slightly changed the way we're approaching them. So we're trying to be there ready on opening day with the Team Empire take, and then in a week, 2 weeks, maybe sometimes 3 weeks, you'll get the filmmaker interview and maybe even a second Team Empire take as well. So it is a good time to be subscribing because you had a lot of stuff in July and you're going to have a lot of stuff in August as well. And then I might die.
Oh, well, you did it doing what you loved, editing podcasts.
We're looking into it. So there we go. Anyway, we gave this one 4 stars. 4 stars then for the Fantastic Four First Steps. Join us next week for more film-related fun as we barrel into August, and we'll be joined by the director of The Naked Gun, the first Naked Gun movie in donkey's years, Akiva Schaffer, 1/3 of The Lonely Island, will be on this podcast talking about that. And there may be someone else as well, because I can never rule that out. But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. You're still here, James, right?
Just yes, double checking.
Okay, good. James Dyer, bye-bye.
Bye, Chris.
Bye, James.
I'm snoozing now, not musing.
Snooze in your movie news muse.
That's right.
With your muse.
You snooze, you muse.
Yeah, are you eating muesli in your movie news muse?
Oh, stop it. Who eats muesli?
Is it next to a farm? So you wake up in your movie news muse, your movie news muse, and then you have some movie news muesli.
Does he drink booze?
I'm going to go and have some movie news booze. Yeah.
No, relentlessly tickled by that. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.